I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on Science and Sense.
Whether we are scientists or slackers, whether we're farmers or physicists, we've all been born into a culture that profoundly conditions and constrains our senses. And I think that this culture deeply conditions all of its members to not really notice the enigmatic wonder of the world that surrounds us on every hand, to not really notice that that world is actually there.
From time to time, researchers test the public's understanding of science. The public, predictably, turns out to be woefully ignorant. 20% think the moon is made of green cheese. 30% think an electron is bigger than a molecule, and so forth. But for David Abram, this demonstrably shaky grasp of the details misses the point. He thinks we are conditioned by scientific understandings at a much deeper level, and that the main effect of this conditioning is to make us distrust our senses. For citizens of the Republic of Technoscience, he says, the real world is not the one we can touch and taste. It's the one that is disclosed by particle physics or radio astronomy. David Abram is a teacher and a writer whose book, The Spell of the Sensuous, has been widely read and much praised. He believes that we ought to snap out of our technological trance and literally come to our senses. Today on Ideas, he shares his thoughts as we continue with our series on how to think about science. Here's Ideas producer David Cayley.
In a recent essay, David Abram looks back on the high school science education he experienced as a nature-loving boy growing up on Long Island in the 1970s. He begins with the earnest physics teacher, who announced to the class that the apparent solidity of the table on which he was sitting was an illusion, the table actually being composed of empty space, shot through with tiny whirling particles. Next came biology, taught entirely in a laboratory-like classroom with no reference to the living world surrounding the school. There, the teacher explained that animal behavior is programmed in each creature's genes, that the cardinals, thrushes, and blackbirds whose songs had entranced young Abram were, as he says, not really saying anything. They were just feathered automatons, obeying coded instructions. David Abram took this familiar style of scientific education unusually hard. The singing, speaking world disclosed by his senses had mattered to him. It was a blow to find his teachers treating this world as nothing more than a hollow and mechanical appearance, a will-of-the-wisp emanating from the more fundamental realm disclosed by mathematical formulas and high-powered instruments. But what he learned in school was, he thinks, typical. In his view, most of us come to assume, one way or the other, that the world as science knows it is somehow more real than the world as we experience it. And for him, this gets things entirely upside down. The real world is the one we can touch and taste, hear, smell, and see. Science is only its abstract or diagram, unintelligible except by reference back to sensory experience. David Abram wants to restore the primacy of the senses and put science in its proper place as a powerful and useful but still secondary form of knowledge. In today's program, he talks about how modern techno-scientific civilization lost its grounding in the soil of the sensible and how it can regain it. Speaking from a radio studio in Santa Fe, New Mexico, nearby his home, he told me a little about how he came to understand that it is by our senses that we are in the world, and the world in us. One of the ways he learned, he said, was through the profession he first adopted to put himself through college, sleight of hand magician.
As a result of practicing this craft of magic and sleight of hand magic, I became very, very interested in perception and in our ordinary sensorial experience of the world. Perception, it turns out, is the medium for a magician, as pigments are the medium for a painter. Magicians work with this very malleable and quite mysterious element that we call perception, perceptual experience. Whether one is a contemporary sleight of hand conjurer or a traditional indigenous shaman or medicine person, one is still working with the fluid quality of perception itself. Magicians are those who are adept at altering or shifting the accepted conventional perceptual experience of their community, whether it is in order to enter into rapport or communication with another shape of intelligence, such as a spider or a wolf or a whale, or in the contemporary world, magicians practice somewhat the same thing, often just for entertainment purposes, which is a kind of fallen away aspect of magic and the deep meanings that have always been there in the practice of magic. But it was from my craft as a sleight-of-hand magician that I became so fascinated with sensory experience and with how our eyes, our ears, our skin feel and make contact with the larger world around us, how they bring us into a kind of felt reciprocity with the living world that we inhabit.
One of the things that brought the world alive in this way for David Abram was a year he spent in Asia, comparing notes, so to say, with traditional magicians. He had practiced his sleights in clubs and restaurants in the U.S., worked his way around Europe as a street magician, and spent several months as part of maverick psychiatrist R.D. Lang's Philadelphia Association, where he explored the use of magic in psychotherapy. Then he decided to travel to Indonesia and Nepal, where his abilities gave him an in with the shamans or medicine people of those cultures. It was an experience that so changed him that it was a shock to come home.
When I returned from my first travels among traditional indigenous peoples and communities, when I returned to North America, it was quite a warp in my own felt experience of things, because suddenly I could no longer feel the activity of the shapes around me, of the ground itself. In the course of living with traditional magicians, I found my senses coming awake in a way that they never had in my own culture since I had been a child, as I had grown up into a culture that defined the sensorial surroundings as basically a set of inert or inanimate or at least determinate objects and objective processes, my senses had become blunted. My eyes had sort of glazed over, and I had been living more and more in a set of abstractions. But in the course of living with and conversing with traditional peoples, and in particular these traditional healers and medicine people, I had to learn this way of speaking that allowed each thing its own active agency, its own life. And as I took on this way of speaking, my own senses became much more awake to where I was And I started noticing the outrageousness of the real world that surrounded me on every hand. Stones, small plants, gusts of wind, patches of lichen slowly spreading on a boulder. Everything became fascinating, strangely weird, each in its own way, because I was now listening and looking at things with a kind of expectancy, listening for what they were up to, no longer just defining them as inert or determinate processes. I was sort of sensing that there was an otherness present in every elemental aspect of the earthly world. And it seemed to me that this expectation of otherness, that everything has its own interior spontaneity, that each thing has its own life, that this way of speaking is simply a way of talking in accordance with one's senses and with one's direct sensory experience of the world. It's a way of speaking that holds one's senses awake and aware of the immediate surroundings.
The world is alive, David Abram says, but our senses grow dull as a result of our definitions. The world can't surprise us because we live in what he calls a set of abstractions. The senses are overridden by more general schemes and categories. And this tendency, he thinks, is built into contemporary culture in many ways.
Whether we are scientists or slackers, whether we're farmers or physicists, we've all been born into a culture that profoundly conditions and constrains our senses into very specific modes of encounter with the sensuous terrain. And I think that this culture deeply conditions all of its members to not really notice the enigmatic wonder of the world that surrounds us on every hand, to not really notice that that world is actually there. We've defined away all of the meaning in the sounds that surround us. The voices of the birds and the other sounding animals are not really voices. Certainly they're not saying anything. It's just automatic sounds programmed in their genes as though other organisms are just automatons and some computer programmer came along and inserted new software into them, and that's why they are acting as they do. And hence, there's no mystery there to compel our ears to listen in deeper. There's nothing being said by those birds. And so our ears have become somewhat deaf to anything that does not speak in words. Our eyes have become rather blind to anything that is not human or of human invention, because we have grown into a collective discourse that rather casually speaks of the rest of animate nature as a set of objects and objective processes. There's no creativity there. The movement of a crow or of a spider is not a creative response to what surrounds it in the immediacy of the moment. And so our eyes, yes, glaze over and we become somewhat blind. And I think that this is our common inheritance today, whether we have been steeped in the sciences or whether we've paid them no attention whatsoever. It's part of the collective discourse of our time, a way of speaking that so deeply influences our ways of seeing and of hearing, even of tasting the world around.
David Abram argues that the senses of modern persons have been conditioned into a kind of complacency. Other beings don't speak to us because we have decided in advance that they have nothing surprising to say. This expectation arises from what he names a collective discourse and a common inheritance. It holds all of us, whether or not we are versed in the sciences. Yet science, in a very broad sense, is its source, because it is science, David Abram says, that has been telling us for centuries that the world is not what it seems to our senses.
I think a primary element of the scientific background discourse of our time is the teaching that we should not trust our senses. Every child is born with a kind of exuberant sensorium that wants to participate in every aspect of the sensorial surroundings. But fairly quickly in elementary school and as we proceed through our educational system, we learn and take on in all sorts of ways, both explicit and implicit, that we should not trust our senses, that the senses are deceptive, that the senses lie. It's such a taken-for-granted aspect of the modern moment.
The roots of this distrust of the senses, in David Abram's view, lie deep in the history of science. In fact, he thinks it virtually defines what we call the scientific revolution.
The key aspect of the scientific revolution was this new distance and detachment from our felt sensorial experience. The Copernican revolution, with its outrageous disclosure that the Earth is moving, and not that the sun is moving around the Earth, flew in the face of our direct sensory experience of the sun as this being arcing overhead through the sky and then slipping down beyond the horizon in the evening and then climbing up out of the eastern ground every morning and arcing through the sky. This was our sensory experience of the sun for eons, and we suddenly took on this new way of speaking and of thinking that said that, this is not true, and hence you should not trust your senses. The truth is hidden behind the scenes. It is what the experts, with their access to very high-powered instrumentation, like the new telescopes of the time, must mediate to us. The truth of the world is written, as Galileo said, in the language of mathematics. And our senses bring us a deceitful story of how the world moves. And so the scientific revolution brought this tremendous distance from our senses. And it's not well enough recognized that René Descartes' severance of the thinking mind from the body, his cutting of res cogitans or thinking stuff from the mechanical body. He had to effect this detachment of the thinking intellect from the sensing body in order to, in a way, set up the ontology that was needed by this new state of affairs where we should not trust our senses at all, but should really give ourselves over to the intellectual study of the world as it is hidden behind the scenes.
René Descartes' cut between mind and matter was, in a sense, a defensive operation, David Abram says. It protected the mind from the deceits of the body and of nature. But this attempt to locate humanity outside and above nature also had deep religious roots, he believes. Popular accounts of the scientific revolution have often stressed the tension between the Church and the new natural philosophy of Copernicus and Galileo. But Abram believes that, in a deeper sense, the new science was a renewal of long-established Christian habits of thought.
So many of our comrades and colleagues speak of science as having displaced religion, but that seems very mistaken to me, that so much of the world of modernity, and particularly the scientific discourse of our time, is a continuation of certain deeply religious, many of them Christian, assumptions regarding the distance of the human from the rest of nature, as well as the fallen character of the natural world. Although we no longer, of course, speak of material nature as fallen and sinful and demonic, we now speak of it as inert, mechanical, and determinate, and in many ways dead. But it seems to me that this is just a continuation of the same deeply religious prejudices, but translated into a new, much more modern idiom.
Modern science, in David Abram's estimation, continued the essentially religious theme of humanity's alienation from nature and nature's alienation from God. And the new natural philosophy of the 17th century, in his opinion, also sought an explicit accommodation with official religion. During the Renaissance, he says, the experimental practices that were later characteristic of science were still intertwined with alchemy and magic. Giordano Bruno, burned at the stake by the Roman Inquisition in 1600, is a typical figure. A proto-scientist and follower of Copernicus on the one hand, but still, as we would say today, an animist, accused by the Inquisition of dealing in magics and divination. The Church was threatened by people like Bruno, with their belief in an active and spontaneous nature, Abram thinks, but easily made its peace with the image of nature as a lifeless clockwork.
The modern practice of science was in search of a new lingo that would disarm the wariness and the antagonism of the Church. And mechanism, this whole metaphorics of the world as a vast machine, was the perfect discourse to come in at this time and was grabbed onto by many of the early practitioners of science as a way of speaking that enabled their researches while at the same time implied, well, if the world was a big machine, somebody must have made the machine. There was still this need for a divine source radically transcendent to the material world, a divine inventor, if you will. And so as mechanism became the discourse of modern science, it found itself in a much more fluid and easy relation with the Church of the time, and no longer in a kind of very uneasy and antagonistic relationship. And I think that's a key reason why the discourse of mechanism swept through modernity and has become a sort of taken-for-granted lingo today, so that most people don't even recognize that it's a metaphor. Because, of course, the world is not a machine. It wasn't built from outside. It seems to have been born of itself out of a cosmos that is in a continual process of creation, but of self-creation. So I think that's worth pointing out.
The mechanical philosophy fit in very comfortably, according to David Abram, with an authoritarian religion in which God was conceived as a mighty ruler and lawgiver. The church held that ultimate reality was available only through its mediation. And science made a similar claim about nature. The Bible tells you how to go to heaven, as Galileo is supposed to have said. Science tells you how the heavens go.
There is a sort of tacit alliance in this sense between the mechanical description of material nature and a very conventional Christian understanding of nature as a secondary realm, fallen away from the real source, which is radically transcendent to the sensuous world. That even for many of our brothers and sisters within the sciences, who may speak of themselves as avowed atheists, they nonetheless tend to view the material or sensuous world around them, the world of our direct experience, as a kind of secondary dimension, derivative from a more primary realm, that this world that we experience is not nearly as real as that hidden dimension of subatomic particles, of quarks and gluons and mesons. But then there are other researchers who will say, yes, but of course our experience of things is also caused by happenings unfolding deep in the nucleus, not just of the atom, but deep in the nucleus of our cells, in the genome, and the interactions between various strands of DNA, to which we gain access, again, only with very high-powered and expensive equipment and instrumentation. So in these and many other ways, modern scientific discourse keeps telling us to not trust our senses and our direct sensory experience of the real, but to assume that the world we inhabit and experience is really explained by dimensions hidden elsewhere. And this is in so many ways a perpetuation of the theological presumption that material nature is itself to be explained by reference to a divine source hidden entirely beyond all bodily ken.
You're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1 in Canada, across North America on Sirius Satellite Radio 137, and around the world on cbc.ca. The program is called How to Think About Science, and it's presented by David Cayley.
Science, at the time of which David Abram has been speaking, was a new philosophy, struggling to establish its legitimacy. By the turn of the 20th century, its assumptions had become the new common sense. Its view of nature so much taken for granted, as David Abram said a moment ago, that people no longer even noticed that mechanism was only a metaphor. Science came to dominate modern societies, and it was this domination that gave rise to the philosophical school that has most inspired David Abram, phenomenology. Its founder was a German-speaking philosopher, Edmund Husserl, who lived between 1859 and 1938.
Husserl, as the founder of phenomenology, was recognizing that the sciences had, by the early 20th century, become so thoroughly estranged from the world of our direct experience that they were threatening, by their ongoing researches, to even destroy that world, as well as that they had been taking us humans further and further from our felt experience of things. And so he set about developing a philosophy that would serve as sort of the ground for the other sciences by being a science of perception, a science of experience itself, from which the other more abstract sciences could launch themselves without then necessarily setting themselves in opposition to our felt experience. And so phenomenology proceeded as the investigation of the world as we experience it prior to reflection, prior to the thematization of mathematics and of science. How do we encounter the world in its immediacy when we just pay attention?
Edmund Husserl wanted to recover an experience of things that had not already been cut and dried by the analytical mind. But in David Abram's view, he still held humanity aloof from nature in certain crucial ways. With Husserl, the consciousness or awareness to which the world shows itself is still outside nature, independent of the body, even though the body is the location of this awareness. He was still, in this sense, a Cartesian. It remained for a student of his, the French phenomenologist Maurice Merleau-Ponty, to take the next step and argue that the body is not just the location of consciousness, it is consciousness itself.
Merleau-Ponty made a sort of radical move to step out of Cartesianism entirely and to say that, well, the very one that is experiencing this consciousness that Husserl was alluding to, this bare awareness, is none other than the body itself. That the body is the being of awareness, that the body is aware, the body is the subject of experience, the experiencing being. And this was a very radical move to make. And in some ways, Merleau-Ponty had to develop, invent a whole new way of speaking to begin to step out of the Cartesian predilections of our contemporary discourse, to open up another way of speaking that would not tear us continually out of our senses and carry us out of our bodies.
With Merleau-Ponty, we arrive at the project that David Abram has taken up and carried forward in his own work. Merleau-Ponty overcame the separation of mind and body in Cartesian philosophy and relocated mind in nature. "Our thoughts are the world's thoughts," he said. "Our flesh, the world's flesh. If I think the sky blue, then, to take an example from David Abram's writings, the sky is equally thinking itself blue through me. If I speak of the world, then the world also speaks in me." In Merleau-Ponty's view, even language, so often taken as the crown and seal of human uniqueness, is not our exclusive possession, but belongs to the world to which we are giving voice. And this is an aspect of Merleau-Ponty's thought which David Abram has been particularly interested in extending and enriching.
One of the discoveries that was central to Merleau-Ponty's phenomenology was a recognition that to the sensing and sentient human animal, it's not just that everything is in some sense animate and alive, but also that everything speaks, that any sound can be a voice, that any movement can be a gesture, a meaningful expression, that expressiveness is a property of the world itself. Everything around me has at least the capacity for meaningful speech. Even the hum of the fluorescent lights in the ceiling overhead, that too is a kind of voice, because there is a kind of meaningfulness present in sound itself. It's not an articulate meaning necessarily, but that the particular sound of the tires of some cars whooshing along the wet streets in a rain at night, that sound affects the listening organism of our body. It slips us into a certain mood, just as the songs of birds affect our mood or affect our state of mind. Sounds influence us, and we respond. And in some sense, our own human languages were all born as a call for and a response to the whole world of sounding expressive shapes that we inhabited. I mean, it's quite clear, for instance, that our indigenous ancestors, hunting and gathering forebears, were quite dependent on their ability to listen in on and learn from and even mimic the sounds of other animals. In order to draw those animals close, one had to sometimes make utterances that were very much like the sound of those partridges or the cries of those hooved beasts that you wanted to get close enough to kill. Of course, this is before we had anything like guns. You had to get quite close to another animal if you wanted to bag it for dinner. So for that huge stretch of our existence as Homo sapiens, we were in a very close rapport, a very intimate and attentive attunement with at least those other animals on which we depended for our sustenance. And our own languages would seem to have been deeply informed by the calls and the cries of these other animals, as well as by bird songs and even, you know, the sound of the wind in the willows, because this too would seem to be a kind of a voice, that each entity has its own eloquence, and our speech is just our part of a much wider conversation.
So what does that say to the view of scientific linguistics, that our languages are largely arbitrary codes?
Well, of course, that's how you have to think of language if you're going to continue to conceive language as an exclusively human property. You have to separate out all of the felt meaning in our sounds and just focus on a sense of language as a code, wherein each term rather arbitrarily stands in as a sign for a particular meaning. But of course, language is not strictly a code. All of our terms carry a sort of poetic resonance within them that we can never fully cut away. I was just thinking recently, as a simple example, our word thunder and the word lightning, which is our word for that flashing slash of jagged light that cuts through the sky. Before then comes this thuddering, shuddering sound we call thunder. But if one tried to reverse those two words and speak of the sound as lightning, because it's arbitrary, right? So let's call that jagged slash of light, let's call that thunder, and call that deep rumbling sound lightning. Well, it wouldn't hold. You could try and practice it for a few days or a few weeks within your community, but pretty quickly it would reverse itself again, because there's something about the word thunder that echoes the sound, not in any immediate, obvious, purely mimicking manner, but it feels right. Certainly, it feels a lot more right than speaking of that sound as lightning. So it's not by chance that the words that we use to speak of the sounding speech of the river as it washes through the banks are words like wash or splash or gush, because the sound that those words all share, shh, is the very sound that the water speaks as it rolls over the rocks. So our human languages have been informed by many other sounds and voices besides those of our own kind. And of course, then it follows from this that as we dam up all of our rivers and clear-cut more and more of our last forests, as there are fewer and fewer songbirds in the surroundings due to the destruction of their wetlands and their wintering grounds in the tropics, our own human languages lose more and more of their meaningfulness because they're no longer informed by and influenced by the splashing speech of those dammed up rivers or by the cadences of the warbler and the wren.
Language will diminish, David Abram says, if we silence the world around us or replace it with manufactured sounds. And more of his contemporaries do live, he thinks, in a kind of technological enclosure or techno-scientific second nature. Scientific abstractions replace experience, and digital technologies project us into what Abram calls bodiless spaces. His response is to keep reminding people that underlying both science and technology, there is still what he calls a more primordial reciprocity between the human organism and its world.
Today we are surrounded by a kind of cocoon of technologies and often seem to have very little direct access to the more than human field of life. Everything seems to be an artifact. Everything I encounter in this room with my gaze is an ingenious invention of my own species. Until I look closer, until I realize, well, I'm still breathing air as I'm sitting here. And the air that is moving between me and this microphone is still the air that is being the oxygen that's breathed out by all the green and rooted folks that surround this studio by the grasses and the trees out there. And I'm breathing in what they're breathing out, and I'm breathing out what they're breathing in. I'm still under the influence of gravity as I sit here. That is this very strange mystery, really, that holds my body to the body of the earth. And this, too, I think, is a great mystery, gravity. It was an uncanny mystery to our brothers and sisters at the dawn of the scientific revolution. But once it began to be spoken of as a law, the law of gravity, as soon as we speak of it as a law, well, then we stop noticing it because it's just happening automatically. So there's nothing very mysterious there. But what is this mystery? We define it even today as the mutual attraction between bodies at a distance, which is as good a definition of Eros, as I know, the attraction of my body for the body of the earth and of the earth's flesh for my flesh, that I am in a kind of ongoing erotic relation to the earth at every moment, as is each stone that I toss up into the air that finds its way right back to contact with the ground. But how different our experience would be if we recognize that gravity is Eros. So it seems to me that with a bit of attention, as well as a careful attentiveness to how we speak, we can begin to notice and make evident once again how wild and quite outrageous still is this interaction or reciprocity between our organism and a larger world that we did not create nor invent, the world that created us.
For David Abram, our belonging to the world, our reciprocity with it, is the foundation on which all our science and technology is built. And it is also the foundation of ethics. In a recent essay called Earth in Eclipse, he has a rather terrifying passage on the mass killings at Columbine High School in Colorado a few years ago. In this passage, he quotes a lifelong friend of one of the killers, who told a reporter, I'm quoting, "What they did wasn't about anger and hate. It was about them living in the moment like they were inside a video game." Abram goes on to speculate that perhaps these two young men, who spent an extraordinary amount of time in virtual spaces, had lost contact altogether with the sympathies of embodied existence, that neither they nor the people they killed were altogether real. For it is from the body, and the body of the earth, David Abram says, that our sympathies come.
Ethics is not first and foremost a set of rules or principles that we learn from a book or a teacher. It is first and foremost a kind of sense in our bones. Ethics in this sense is the ability to move in this world without unnecessarily violating the ability of other bodies to move in their own way, how to give space to others, how to restrain oneself where my exuberance or anger might impede the ongoing exuberance of another person. Ethics as how not to do violence, it seems to me, is something we learn first and foremost as bodily beings. To the extent that we are living today in a technologically mediated world that cuts us off from our senses and has us living in a field of abstractions, almost oblivious to our bodily senses and to the sensuous earth around us, I think it's very hard to be ethical. It's very hard to know what it is to live in right relation with others, both with other people and with the other shapes and forms of our world. It's also very difficult for environmental activists like myself to mobilize people to act on behalf of another forest about to be clear-cut, another wetland about to be paved over and developed, or even on behalf of global climate change these days, because people don't really feel any deep affinity with the earthly world that they inhabit. The body is our primary access to that world. And to the extent that we are living such disembodied lives, to the extent that we also are projecting the deepest truth of things into some dimension entirely transcendent to the sensuous, whether it be a heaven hidden behind the stars or a subatomic world hidden inside the nucleus of the atom, I'm still not really living and participating with all of my intelligence here in this world. And so I don't feel any deep affinity with this world when I hear that other species are going extinct at unprecedented rates, or even that the climate is changing rapidly. That's interesting, but it doesn't affect me that deeply because this isn't my real home. My realer, truer home is somewhere else.
This feeling that real life is elsewhere has partly arisen from a scientific worldview, as David Abram has stressed a number of times in today's program. But the problem for him is not science as such. He thinks that science, as a stance, has its place and its benefits. He objects only to the way in which science has overcome sensory experience and estranged us from the natural world. And what he hopes for, finally, is a homecoming.
I am in no way trying to disparage science nor technology. I am trying to argue that there is a world, a field of experience that we need to reclaim as our real home, as the primary dimension of human life and experience and relationship, and that that is the world of our direct corporeal, sensorial experience, the world of community, not with those who I like to dialogue with online, but the community of those who I meet face to face in the flesh in my own neighborhood. So beginning to recognize a certain primacy to place or to the sensuous, which is another way of saying the same thing, and to begin to practice a way of speaking, of languaging, that allows that primacy is not to disparage or say we should not also pay attention to what's happening on the other side of the planet or to be engaging with the internet, but rather to be recognizing that there is one realm that is kind of the soil, the ground within which all these other more abstract dimensions remain rooted and from which they still tacitly or secretly are drawing their nourishment.
Writer and teacher David Abram, recorded at radio station KSFA in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's the author of The Spell of the Sensuous. How to Think About Science will continue next week at this time with a program on the role of science in the collapse of Canada's cod fishery.
On Ideas, you've listened to How to Think About Science. Today's program was produced and presented by David Cayley, with the help of Bernie Lucht, Dave Field, and Liz Nage. If you'd like an audio copy of this or any other Ideas program, if you want to know what's coming up on the show, or if you'd like to learn more about CBC podcasting, just go to our website at cbc.ca/ideas. We've also created a web page for this series where sound files of the programs will be posted. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht. I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now to CBC Radio 1 and to Sirius Satellite Radio for the hourly news.